This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Before the turn of the 20th century, the South was notorious for having the worst roads in the country. This region was a raggedy sketchbook of dirt roads and horse paths. You could barely get from county to county, let alone state to state. But with the rise of the auto industry and the help of the Good Roads Movement, the Dixie Highway was born, and it became the first network of roads to link the South to the North. Tammy Ingram is a professor of history at the College of Charleston and the author of Dixie Highway, Road Building, and the Making of the Modern South. She joins us now. Tammy Ingram, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. I'm happy to be here.
How did you get interested in Southern roads?
Well, sort of by accident. I was fishing around for a dissertation topic a little over 10 years ago now, and initially thought that I would write something about internal migration in the South during the Great Migration. And as I started doing research, I realized that all the political debates in the South around that time, especially at the local level, but also at the state level as well, were about roads. And so as I started trying to figure out how exactly people were moving around in the South, I realized that that was a very difficult thing for them to do if they couldn't use trains. So it sort of evolved into a project about roads. Also had something to do with the fact that my very first research grant in graduate school was from the North Carolina Society to look at some of their materials on the Good Roads Movement. And that really convinced me that there was enough material out there to do something. And you know, coupled with the scarcity of, materials about road building during this period, I just decided that, you know, someone had to do it. And it was really interesting to me. So
tell us about the Good Roads Movement.
Well, the Good Roads Movement really started in the very late 19th century because bicycling was a popular pastime. So it started among a pretty elite group of bicycle enthusiasts, mostly in the North and the Midwest, who wanted better roads to ride their bicycles on. But by the turn of the 20th century, it was taken over by automobile enthusiasts. And instead of advocating for just local roads to ride bicycles on, there was really a big push to build interstate, interregional roads that would allow people with automobiles to travel farther, faster. And it was very, very popular nationwide, but it was especially popular in the South because the South was so isolated by the condition of its poor roads.
Yeah, and getting back to that, you talked about the Great Migration, looking at that, but there was a smaller migration that took place before, and that is people moving not to the big cities in Chicago, but into the larger cities or larger urban areas within the South. And that's when the absence of good roads really made itself known, right?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, a lot of people who were trying to participate in the Great Migration and leave the South would often go to cities first. And some of them stayed there permanently. Others ended up moving on. But it was easier in some sense if you were already in a big city or if you happened to be in a town that was linked by railroads to a large city, it was easier for those people to get out of the South. But for a lot of people, it was more challenging just to get from their small town in South Georgia, say, to a larger city like Atlanta.
Of course, this speaks volumes about the connection between North and South. If we didn't need roads that connected them, it means that there wasn't a whole lot of need. There wasn't a lot of commerce, popular or otherwise, North and South, I guess. Isn't that what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were certain connections, obviously, because rail networks were quite sophisticated by the turn of the 20th century. But farmers were notoriously opposed to the railroads because of their unfair freight rates. And it really limited marketing opportunities for farmers. But it also limited business opportunities in the South as well. And that's why some of the most vocal proponents of the Good Roads Movement and some of the most vocal supporters of the Dixie Highway in particular were local businessmen who wanted new business opportunities to come into the South. They wanted to be able to expand businesses that they already had, and certainly from farmers who wanted more flexible marketing opportunities for crops that they were already growing and also for new crops like fruit trees and things like that that became very popular in the South around that time.
Interestingly enough, the railroad industry was supportive of the Good Roads Movement, right?
Well, they were initially, because like everyone else, the railroads assumed that roads were simply feeder routes to feed local traffic into railroad depots, and then railroads would handle all of the long-distance traffic. So if you were to look at a map at that time, that there were very, very few maps that of local road systems. It would look like spokes on a wheel, with the railroad depot at the center and local roads branching out into neighboring farm communities. But they didn't link up with one another, and they didn't link up with roads that led to other towns. But by the time the automobile became popular, and it became very popular in the South very quickly, railroads withdrew their support of the Good Roads Movement when they realized that these long-distance highways were going to be competitors instead of just feeder routes for the railroads.
So tell us about the Dixie Highway. It's not a single highway. It's a network of highways. But tell us about that.
That's right. Well, it was in the early 20th century, there were a lot of people talking about the need for a north-south route, but it really didn't get off the ground until 1914 when an Indianapolis businessman named Carl Fisher proposed it. And he had a lot of important political connections and was very wealthy and was able to get this project off the ground. He also happened to have just bought a little mosquito-infested piece of swamp land off the coast of Miami that he wanted to turn into a resort city called Miami Beach, and he did that. And he was interested in selling real estate. And so he proposed a single route from Chicago to Miami in the fall of 1914. But over the winter and spring, as this project started to gain some momentum, Southerners, Midwesterners as well, but especially rural Southerners, were so excited about this route that they all mounted a very vigorous campaign to be included on the route. And as a result of that routing contest in the spring of 1915, Carl Fisher and other people who had come together by that point to form the Dixie Highway Association agreed that a single route would really not serve the interests and desires of people along the route, and instead they proposed a sort of ring route with eastern and western divisions. It looked like a sort of long, skinny circle that looped through the Midwest and the South and covered, by the time it was complete, covered about 6,000 miles. And it was mostly composed of existing local roads that were stitched together and marked with signs, but it constituted the first long-distance route in and out of the South, and as I argue in the book, really the first sophisticated interstate highway network in the nation's history.
Well, how much actual road building was involved in that first iteration?
There wasn't very much. In certain places in the mountains, there was some construction that was necessary. But for the most part, they tried to select roads that were already local roads that were already in pretty good shape. And they improved them and tried to keep them up to standard so that they could withstand heavy automobile traffic. But in some cases, as I said before, a lot of local roads didn't link up. So sometimes there was some construction necessary just to link up a good road in one city or a town with that of a town just to the north or south of it. But for the most part, it was just a matter of stitching together roads that already existed. That's why it looks pretty smooth and simple if you look at the map of the entire network. But up close, it was actually a very winding and meandering route.
And who were the early beneficiaries? I guess farmers were the first ones to really start to feel the effect. Am I right?
Well, certainly farmers were, and they were big supporters of the highway to begin with and really lobbied hard to make sure that the highway went through their communities. But so were local businessmen who really understood that there were all kinds of new opportunities for them in the Dixie Highway as well. And, you know, ultimately it spawned a lot of new industries by creating an infrastructure for tourism in the South. You have to remember that in those days, cars didn't go as far as fast as they do today, even if the roads were in good condition. And so tourists needed more hotels more frequent intervals. They needed ways to refuel their vehicles. They needed mechanics at more frequent intervals. And so a lot of businessmen saw, too, that there were a lot of new business opportunities in the tourist industry that a lot of places in the South had never considered before.
Interesting how the Dixie Highway fueled the debate, or perhaps initiated the debate, over local and state and federal control as questions of who's going to pay for all this became important. Tell us more
That's
about
absolutely
that.
Absolutely right. Yeah, and this is really sort of what the book is about. It's not just about the construction of the highway, but more about the political processes behind that. At the time that the Dixie Highway was first proposed in late 1914, roads were not only local in scope, as I was describing earlier, but they were also funded and administered almost entirely locally. Very few states had state highway departments, and those that did weren't you know, the highway departments weren't very well funded and they weren't very powerful. But over the lifespan of the Dixie Highway, road building passed from almost total local control into the hands of state and federal bureaucracies and really set up that three-part local, state, federal system of roads and highways that we have today. It was initially a popular thing because everybody realized that in order to build long, ambitious, modern highways like the Dixie Highway, local governments alone could not do that. They needed help from state and federal agencies. They needed additional sources of revenue. But in the South, there was a backlash against that by the mid-1920s as local Southerners realized that they had given up an enormous amount of control, an enormous source of patronage and a lot of money to these state and federal bureaucrats who were not elected officials.
Go ahead. I was going to ask you about the Dixie Highway Associations and the role they played in regulating the roads.
Well, the Dixie Highway Association was composed of about 14 or so officers. Each state along the route had two representatives in the Dixie Highway Association. They met once, sometimes twice a year in Chattanooga, which was roughly the midway point on the route between the original route between Chicago and Miami. And they were sometimes newspaper editors. Some of them were just very wealthy businessmen. Some of them had in the past served in local and state government. And they were just prominent citizens whose responsibility it was to make sure that the work on the Dixie Highway was actually being done. And this was very important because a lot of these other marked trails, they sometimes call them, or memorial highways, had sprung up all over the country in the early 20th century. And a lot of them were just schemes to solicit money from people, and there was never actually any road built as a result of it. So they were really monitoring it to make sure that everybody took the Dixie Highway seriously and realized that it was a legitimate project. And sometimes if a county was not, or city officials were not living up to their promises to make sure that the highway remained in good condition, they would actually reroute it through another town because they were very determined to make sure that the highway was passable for tourists year-round. And so they played they were unofficial people. They weren't necessarily – they weren't government officials, but as private citizens and as leaders in the Dixie Highway Association, they fulfilled a very important role in making sure that the highway was up to standards.
And the Dixie Highway was also important to African Americans as well. Tell us more about that.
That's right. Well, it was in a couple of different ways. Obviously, it's very important to rural African Americans to have some better control over their own mobility. And railroads, for very obvious reasons, didn't provide that, both because people couldn't afford them and also, obviously, trains were segregated at the time. But African Americans were among the foremost adopters of the automobile, and it gave them a kind of independence and control over their own mobility that they had never had before. So it certainly helped to facilitate and accelerate, in many ways, the Great Migration. The flip side of that is that African Americans were exploited in order to build the highway, in order to build all roads during that time, through chain gangs. And Georgia, which is the state that I focus on most in the book, chain gangs were a part of the progressive reform agenda in the early 20th century. They replaced convict leases, which had leased, of course, prisoners out to private companies like railroad companies and sawmills. And people saw that as being very abusive, but also as benefiting private entities instead of the public good. And so by putting prisoners to work on the roads, progressives argued that that was both rehabilitating the men but also rehabilitating the roads themselves. But, of course, in practice, putting people who had been abused and beaten and starved and in many cases put into jail under false charges in the first place, putting them to work on the road with hoes and pickaxes and shovels was really no way to build a modern highway. And so at the very same time that Southerners are trying to modernize and are trying to finish this great project that the Dixie Highway was, they were recommitting themselves to a very brutal and primitive system of labor that really was out of sync with the goals of the modern Good Roads Movement.
And this Dixie Highway movement, the Good Roads Movement itself, is all taking place as the vacation industry is getting underway. And ground zero for that is Asheville, North Carolina. So there is now a tourism industry. How did that play a role in the Dixie Highway, or did it?
Well, it did. It was very important. And actually, Western North Carolina, as a lot of your listeners will know, was already a very important tourist destination in the South even before the Dixie Highway. But North Carolina was not on the original route of the highway, but they were actually – the Carolina Extension was added roughly around 1920. I don't know the precise date, but it was the last major addition to the original route that had been chosen in the spring of 1915. And one of the reasons they did that is because the tourist industry was already so well established in Western North Carolina, and because of that, the roads were actually in fairly good condition, much better, in fact, than they were in most other parts of the South, that it was pretty much a no-brainer for Dixie Highway Association officials to agree to add the Carolina Extension. So it spurred east off of Knoxville, which was on the original route, and passed through Asheville and down through the upstate of South Carolina and reconnected with the original route of the Dixie Highway somewhere around Augusta, Georgia.
I've only got about a half minute left, but what happened to the Dixie Highway?
Well, it basically lasted for about a decade. In some ways, it was a victim of its own success. Between the mid-1910s and the mid-1920s, the highway was completed, but it ended up being absorbed by state highway systems and the first federal U.S. system of U.S. highways because they were trying to, just as Dixie Highway Associations had been with local roads, they were trying to absorb roads that were already in the best condition and that connected all of the most important towns and cities. And in the Dixie Highway states, that was the Dixie Highway. And state agencies and the federal government made the Dixie Highway Association take down their signs because they were not official – it was not an official route. And so it became chopped up and absorbed into various state highways and U.S. highways. It was successful, but it lost its original markings. Though these days there is a move, I know there's a big one in Georgia right now, to locate the original route of the highway and to put up historic markers. And in parts of the Midwest, that's already been done as well.
Fascinating story. Tammy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Tammy Ingram is a professor of history at the College of Charleston and the author of Dixie Highway, Road Building and the Making of the Modern South. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program's produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.